From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Korean Context, a podcast dedicated to all things Korea. This week, we have a really great episode for you. I recently had the privilege of interviewing Ned Forney, a writer currently based in Seoul who's working on a book about the Hungnam evacuation, an operation during the Korean War in which 100,000 refugees were rescued by American troops. Ned has a particular tie to this story because his grandfather, Colonel Edward Forney, was one of the officers in charge of orchestrating that evacuation in 1950. Ned was in Washington, D.C. for just a couple of days to take part in a ceremony at the National Museum of the Marine Corps, which was the very first stop for President Moon Jae-in during his inaugural visit to Washington. The ceremony was a particularly meaningful one for Moon, whose parents were on one of the boats that safely made it out of North Korea, thanks to Colonel Forney. So it's really cool that Ned was able to be there and take part in that ceremony. Please enjoy this fascinating conversation, which was recorded while Ned was in town for the event. So first of all, I really want to thank you for taking your time. I know you're having a very brief visit here to DC, so I appreciate, you know, you taking aside the time to talk to me for the podcast.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
So I think what would be good is for some of our listeners who may not be that well-versed in the history of the Korean War, would you mind starting off with a brief summary of the Chosin Reservoir battle and the subsequent evacuation? Why is that an important part of the war?
Yeah, sure. Maybe what I'll do just very briefly is, you know, June 25th, 1950 is when the war started. North Korea invaded the South. And then there was one area of the country that hadn't been taken over called the Pusan Perimeter. And then, of course, MacArthur on September 15th does the Incheon landing, which changes the whole tide of the war. The Marines and the Army go barreling up into North Korea. And they get as far as almost the Yalu River. Actually, some units do get to the Yalu River, which Mao had warned repeatedly not to do. MacArthur didn't listen. So we did go that far north. And, of course, in late October, early November, the Chinese enter the war. So once they enter the war, the Marines in the 10th Corps, the 1st Marine Division was attached to 10th Corps, an Army unit. They were up in the area called the Chosin Reservoir. It's actually in Korea called the Changjin Reservoir, but we had Japanese maps, and the Japanese maps called it Chosin Reservoir. So we're the 1st Marine Division and the 31st Regimental Combat Team are up there at the Chosin Reservoir, and they're surrounded by the Chinese. And it's bitterly cold. It's 20 below, wind chills, and heavy snow, and there's only one road. They called it the MSR, the main supply route, that took all the supplies up into the Chosin Reservoir from Hamhung and Hungnam, which were two towns. Hungnam's actually a port right on the coast, on the northeast coast of North Korea. So they're all there, and they finally break out. As the Marine General in charge of the 1st Marine Division, General Smith, says, we were just attacking in another direction. So they attack towards Hamhung and Hungnam, where the ships are waiting for them to take them, to rescue them, to take them back down to the south. So that was the Changjin, or the Chosin Reservoir campaign, brutal. The casualties were extremely high. The whole world was watching. MacArthur was watching very carefully. Mao was watching very carefully. And Mao had told his troops, if we annihilate the Marines there, Truman will probably pull America out of the war and we would regroup in Japan. So we do escape from Changjin, but then Hungnam becomes very important because once you escape, you still have to get your guys on the ships, your tanks, your jeeps, your trucks, the ammunition, the supplies, everything. Which my grandfather, Colonel Forney, was responsible for. He was a Marine, U.S. Marine colonel, attached to the 10th Corps, and he was General Almond's deputy chief of staff. So he organizes the evacuation, and there were hundreds of thousands of North Korean refugees there who were fleeing the communists. In a series of about, it took 2 weeks to do the evacuation. He helped along with Admiral Doyle, who was the admiral in charge of all the ships, to get approximately 100,000 refugees on those ships. And today, it's estimated there are 1 million descendants of those refugees, and President Moon Jae-in is one of them.
Right. So you mentioned about your grandfather, that this was that he was in charge of this evacuation. So tell me a little bit about him, about your personal connection to this part of history, and why you decided to write a book about it.
Sure. Yeah. So I never knew my grandfather. He died when I was 2 years old. He was 55 years old in 1965. And one of the things we think, the reason he died so young, he had cancer. And in World War II, he was a lieutenant colonel. And he was sent to, right at the end of the war, about 4 weeks, 3 weeks after they dropped the atomic bomb on Nagasaki, he was sent with the Marines to occupy Nagasaki and help rebuild it, and as a police force, occupying force. So he was there for over a year. So there was a lot of radiation in the area, and so who knows. But he had graduated from the Naval Academy. He was born in 1909, went into the Marines as a young lieutenant, and then served in World War II in the Pacific. And then after the war, I guess about maybe half a year, 6 months before Korean War breaks out, MacArthur goes to the Marine Corps and says, listen, can you send somebody to us to help train the Army guys who he was in charge of? He was in basically the governor, so to speak, of Japan. So he had many Army troops in Japan that he was responsible for. So he said, you know, we need an amphibious expert to help train the Army guys to do amphibious operations in case the Soviet Union were to invade Japan or maybe something would happen on the Korean Peninsula. So my grandfather was in Japan, in Tokyo, when the war started. So he was already there with his team of experts. And then he had a role in the Incheon landing, because once again, MacArthur puts General Almond in charge of the operation of Incheon. And General Almond is not a Marine. He's not an amphibious expert. So he has the Marines helping him, and obviously the Navy. So General Smith and Admiral Doyle and Colonel Forney all come together, and the initial phases of Incheon were all led by Marines, and then the Army units come right after, and then they liberate Seoul. So that's the background. But actually, at Hungnam, General Almond knew that every Marine, every soldier, every rock soldier had to get out of Hungnam. We were trapped, so the only way to get out was by water. So in what becomes a huge military operation, there's also the civilian aspect of it, which I can mention a little bit more later. So the logistics of how you're going to get all these men, and you have to do it quickly, and the Chinese are all around you getting ready to, they're putting pressure. Not a lot, because they had lost so many men up at the Chosin Reservoir that it wasn't a lot of pressure, but they were there. They were in the mountains right above Hunan. So that was the trick, is how do you get all these people in a systematic way on these ships with pressure from the Chinese, and you have to do it by the D-Day was December 24th. Because at 2 p.m. they were scheduled to blow the entire port. And MacArthur and Almond had said, we're not leaving any jeeps, we're not leaving any trucks, tanks, nothing for the communists when we pull out. So that was the pressure that my grandfather was under when he did all that. But the great part of the story is there was a doctor who he became friends with. The doctor had gone to school in Virginia 2 years before the war. He was from North Korea, and he was from Hamhung, which is the town about 10 miles from Hungnam. So he speaks English really well. And when General Almond, about 2 months before this operation, when he meets Dr. Hyun, my grandfather and General Almond were together, and they did a tour of a Marine unit. And Dr. Hyun was part of that Marine unit, that ROC Marine unit. And so they started talking to him, and they said, you speak English really well. Why don't you come work for us? And when he told them, my hometown is Hamhung, and that's where General Ahmed was going to move his headquarters. It all fit in perfectly. So Dr. Hyun became a civil affairs officer for the 10th Corps, which General Ahmed was the officer in charge of. So Dr. Hyun and Colonel Forney become good friends. And as the operation takes place, more and more of the refugees start flooding down into Hunan. And we have guards and we have roadblocks everywhere trying to keep the refugees from coming in, because this is a military operation. We can't have refugees running around where all the tanks are and all the equipment. There's no place for them. But they keep coming and they keep coming. And so Dr. Hyun and Colonel Forney both agreed that something needs to be done. Because when we pull out and the North Koreans come and the Chinese, and they see all these guys with their packs on and their children, obviously they're trying to escape with the enemy, and they'll die. So that was a priority for them. First priority was always getting the military out first. And that's just a reality. It was a military operation. But as the days went on and it got closer and closer to the deadline, then the pressure was on we have to do something for the refugees. So that's when Dr. Hyun and Colonel Forney would go to General Ahmed and say, "Sir, can we figure out a way to get these refugees on the ships?" And initially, General Ahmed and the military in general said, "No, you don't put civilians on military ships. It's a big risk." And we were always worried that North Korean infiltrators were amongst the refugees, and there were some. It was a security problem to just say, "Oh, let the refugees get on ships." You can't do that. But they started to do it, and they would put them on top of the tanks, under the tanks, and on top of the barrels of fuel or whatever, wherever they could fit them in. They started fitting them in. So by the 22nd of December, about 30,000 refugees had already been rescued. So now we're on the 22nd, and the deadline is the 24th. So we have the 22nd, the 23rd, and the 24th, 3 days, and now it's big time panic. And Admiral Doyle somehow got three merchant marine ships in there. They're called Victory ships, huge ships. And the Meredith Victory is the most famous one. And the Meredith Victory's captain, Captain Leonard LaRue, very famous man now. And Bob Lunny, who's a friend of mine, he was a crew member on the ship. He was an officer. He's still alive. He's 90 years old. And he'll be at the ceremony this Wednesday. He's a great guy. And I've interviewed him and two of the other surviving officers. So these ships come in at the last minute, and 14,000 on those merchant marine ships. There was two, Meredith Victory and the Virginia City Victory. Unbelievable. It's a record. Most cruise ships you see today, the massive cruise ships that are down in Miami and 20 stories high and everything, they hold usually around 7,000. And these small merchant marine ships were holding 14,000. So it was just amazing. So by the time they blow the port on the 24th, when they calculate all the numbers of the civilians who got on the merchant marine ships and on the LSTs and on whatever ships they could get on, it was right around 100,000.
Oh, that's amazing. And just a few days getting that many people on ships and getting them out. I mean,
I've interviewed 30 former refugees. So they were there, and they tell me it was just, there was panic, and there was just so much confusion, so many people, and people were so desperate. And whenever I interview them, I always have a translator, because obviously they're speaking in Korean. And usually at some point in the interview, they cry. And some of these are like 85-year-old, really tough Korean guys and women. And they almost always get emotional, especially when they talk about leaving their families. Because most of them thought they were leaving for maybe 3 days or 3 weeks or maybe 3 months, but not forever. And many of them never heard from their families again, never got a letter, no phone calls, nothing. You have no idea.
Right. I know that's a big priority, or has been for several administrations in South Korea, is getting those family reunions started up again. And, unfortunately, circumstances are such that it just hasn't happened.
Man, it's such a tragic story, and it's so sad. And I think many Americans don't realize, the fact that North Korea is there, South Korea is here, and my family is right up there in North Korea, maybe 60, 100 miles away, and I have no idea. what they're doing, if they're alive. I mean, it's just, it's, you know, I think one of your podcasts, you were interviewed and you were talking about, you know, do you live in North or South Korea? Can't live in North Korea.
Definitely. So I'm really interested. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you're doing here in DC? How did this trip come about, and what's the plan?
So in Korea, they have the Ministry of Patriots and Veterans Affairs, very similar to our VA. And so I've worked with them. They've helped put me in contact with refugees, some of the 30 refugees that I've interviewed. And I've gone to many of their events because the Koreans are very appreciative. I mean, of course, across the board, maybe some of the younger Koreans, they don't have quite as much knowledge of what happened during the war. But overwhelmingly, the Koreans are appreciative of what the Americans did for them and for their country during the Korean War. So when the MPVA found out that I was living in Korea, actually they found out my son has lived there for 7 years, so they knew about Colonel Forney way before I even got there, because Ben, who speaks Korean, was going on interviews and writing articles in the Chosun Ilbo in Korean. And so many of the MPVA folks and the government officials and lots of just, you know, people in Seoul knew the story of Colonel Forney and the Hungnam evacuation. And then about 3 years ago, there was a great movie that came out, Ode to My Father. In Korea, it's called Kukje Market. And great, great movie. And the opening scene is Hungnam. And of course, then we would tell people our grandfather was in charge of that operation. And they go, oh, that's so wonderful. So the MPVA has been wonderful, very supportive. You know, the way fate unfolds sometimes, you know, with what happened with Park Geun-hye and now Moon Jae-in, who lost in the last election, he is now president, and he is publicly and frequently talking about his parents. And his parents were on one of those ships that was taking the refugees out in December of 1950. So he's very appreciative. So that's why tomorrow he is going to the National Museum of the Marine Corps in Quantico, where they've just built, about maybe a month or 2 months ago, a memorial to the veterans of Chosun Reservoir. And he'll give a speech there and do a wreath-laying ceremony as a symbolic tribute. And also he's gonna, I think, verbally say that, you know, he's appreciative of what the men did at Chosun, because without them stopping the Chinese, you know, the Chinese would have wiped out Ham Hung and Hung Nam, and his parents would never have escaped. And then the evacuation, he talks about that also frequently. So it's, you know, it's a great tribute to the men who served during that time, the Americans and the ROC forces, and there was also a British unit that was there too, a British commando unit. So he's going to pay tribute, and I was a Marine myself, and so I think it's a great gesture, and I think it's the first step in this U.S.-Korea summit, and it'll be a positive one, I'm hoping.
I think it's really amazing timing. I mean, President Moon coming for his first summit as president right after the anniversary of the start of the war, which was just this past Sunday, and this memorial had just opened. I mean, it couldn't be more perfect as far as timing, right?
The timing's unbelievable, and so I got a call last week from the Korean embassy, and they said, I forgot how they got my number. And they said, oh, they contacted MPVA, and MPVA gave them my number. And the gentleman, the colonel and the ROC Marines called and said, oh, we want you to come to this ceremony. I said, well, I'm in Seoul. And they said, oh, that's okay. So I'm here for 36 hours to see the event, and I'm so honored that I'll be able to be there. Dr. Hyun, who was Colonel Forney's good friend and helped, obviously did a lot to help save the refugees. One of his daughters, who I know well now, she will be there with her husband, and the grandson of General Almond, Colonel Ferguson, who's also a friend of mine, he will be there representing his grandfather. So they did all the research, and they got all these, you know, people together that have some role, or their fathers or grandfathers did. Yeah. So it'll be a great day.
As I just mentioned, the anniversary just happened of the start of the war. The 67th anniversary was this year. So as a former history teacher, what would you think is important for us to remember about the war, about this particular part of the war now 67 years later and looking forward?
Yeah, we went to a ceremony Friday, my son and I, at the fancy Lotte Hotel downtown Seoul, and President Moon was there, and he gave a speech, and he thanked the Chosin Reservoir veterans. He thanked all the UN veterans and the Korean veterans. But he went out of his way to say Chosin and Hoonam. So the thing I get whenever I interview Korean War veterans, U.S. Korean War veterans, and I ask them, you came to Korea, you didn't probably even know where it was on the map. Most of them admit that we didn't know where Korea was, and you saw some of your buddies they didn't come home. Was it worth it? And they always say, every one of them, and they get very passionate when they say it, yes, and I would do it again. I'm so glad that we helped Korea earn their freedom, because they go to Seoul. MPVA pays for them to go to Seoul. There's a special program where they come to Seoul for, I think, 4 or 5 days, and they get to see Seoul and parts of the country. And they're amazed at what the Koreans have done with the freedom we helped give them. And so, it's very moving. And some of them get teary-eyed, and they're like, if I'd known, I wish I'd come earlier, because most of them are in their 80s now, and they actually get a chance to come. So I think we never want war. And my book is going to hopefully show that clearly, that, there's never good war. But sometimes consequences, as the years go by, you see that this was the right thing to do. And Korea is a wonderful country. It's a wonderful democracy. And considering it's such a young democracy, it's a pretty mature democracy. What they did with the candlelight vigils, and, they basically had a turnover of power in a very extreme way, but a very peaceful way. Their government continued even during the protests, and with the current president being put on trial and impeached, their country was operating. And now they have a new president, and it's amazing what they've done. And obviously 13th largest economy in the world. We all have LG appliances in our house, and we have Samsung, and so it's a great success story.
All right, great. Well, I've learned a lot myself, and I hope that the listeners will as well. Before we go, is there anything else that you want to make sure that we know about?
Yeah, I think just the last thing, one of the messages of my book will be that it's important to keep this Korean-American friendship alive, because both countries have a lot in common. And, there are so many Korean-Americans now here in the States, and we have such a partnership, and it's important. Our presidents will come and go, Korean presidents will come and go, but the people, and the governments will stay the same, and we need to keep cooperating militarily, economically, and just do exchanges and tourism, all that. It's important. That would be my final message. Keep the Korean-American friendship strong.
Hey, great. I really like that as an ending. So thank you so much for your time, and have a great time while you're in D.C. for a few hours at least.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me, Jenna.
Thanks, everyone, for once again joining us here on Korean Context. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please feel free to subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and join us again next week for another great episode.